How wonderful, what a great festival it was. Krishna blew his conch shell, which was tinged red, although it was whitish, so white, beautifully, transcendentally white. It was tinged reddish by the touch of Krishna's lips, showing how everything becomes tinged, transcendentally tinged. Even material things become transcendentally tinged when contacted with the Lord. And this is actually the secret of Krishna consciousness, existing spiritually in the material world, that everything has to be contacted with Krishna and tinged with transcendence by using it in his service. But this isn't, it sounds easier than it is, in the sense that, yes, it sounds easy. Just use everything in Krishna's service. But what is the difficulty? The difficulty is that we for so long have had this desire, a nasty habit of wanting to use everything in our own service, thinking that things are meant for our enjoyment, viewing ourselves as the center of existence, so to speak. So this is unfortunate because it hinders our being spiritual in the material world. We are spiritual, but we have our anchor. We have our anchors dropped due to our tendencies for material enjoyment. And these naturally, as anchors, hinder the progress of a boat. Similarly, these tendencies, this just petty selfishness, it hinders our advancement towards the actual goal of life. That thing, that person, whom if we had that relationship with, Krishna, then the actual nature of our soul would be complete, because we are Krishna's part and parcel. Yaj gyatva na punamoham evam yashati pandava yena bhutana sheshashi draksis yapmam tomayi. That the truth is that we are Krishna's. We are part of Him. We are inseparable from Him. It is not that we can ever break our relationship with Krishna. It is impossible. The closest thing one can do to break his eternal relationship with Krishna is Sayujya Mukti, to merge with the One, with the Brahman. And then the seed of our relationship with Krishna is fried and will not manifest. But other than that, everyone has a forgotten relationship with Krishna, or a living in their relationship with Krishna. This is wonderful. This is solace, actually. So how to awaken that relationship with Krishna? Why should we relationship with Krishna? What is that goal, prayojana? What is that necessity? This is what the Bhagavatam teaches. So here, in this first canto, this is actually the end of a very intimate segment of the Bhagavatam. In this first canto, starting in chapter 7, continuing to chapter 8, in 7 we saw Krishna as he was driving the chariot of Arjuna, capturing Asatthama and solving the problems of the Pandavas, what to do with this heinous rascal who had killed the sleeping sons of Draupadi. Then Krishna was leaving, going to Dwarka, and Uttara Devi approached him because the Brahmastra was thrown by Asatthama, and Krishna saved Uttara Devi, the Pandavas, and Prikit Maharaj, who was within the womb of Uttara. And then Kunti Devi offered wonderful prayers. And then, as Krishna was about to leave, Yudhisthira Maharaj approached Krishna in great distress. And due to that, due to his anguish, Krishna stayed on further and brought the Pandavas before Bhishma Dev, who was leaving his body. When Bhishma Dev finally left after having instructed Yudhisthira and after having focused his mind, fixed his mind one-pointed samadhi on Krishna at the time he left his body, then Yudhisthira Maharaj began ruling. And then the kingdom was running so nicely, Krishna stayed to give solace to Subhadra Devi, who had lost her son, and to give support to Yudhisthira. And then finally Krishna left. He left Hastinapur after hearing the wonderful words of praise of the ladies of Hastinapur who were upon the roofs. And in those prayers, they glorified Dwarka, the residents of Dwarka, because of their fortune of being able to see Krishna. This is actually the purpose of our eyes. Otherwise, in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, it is described that if our eyes aren't able to see Krishna, they are no better than the eyes of a peacock feather, or a more contemporary example, the eye of a needle. We call it an eye, both of them eyes, but they have no value as eyes because they don't fulfill the purpose of eyes, because the purpose of eyes is to see. So although they are named eyes, they have no ability to see. So similarly, the eye of a person who does not see Krishna, they are compared to the eye of a peacock feather. They are not fulfilling their actual purpose, the purpose of an eye. So the ladies of Hastinapur were glorifying the residents of Dwarka because of their great fortune of being able to constantly, daily see Krishna. And still more fortunate were the queens of Krishna because of the depth of the intimacy of their relationship with Krishna, something that these ladies could just dream about. But the ladies of Dwarka, they had their relationship with Krishna. This is the nature of the material world. Once you touch it, you get stuck and you can't untangle yourself. So, Krishna left Hastinapur, was accompanied by Yudhisthira Maharaj and the armies out of their affection, thinking that Krishna needed their protection, wanting to be with Krishna. And then finally Krishna entered Dwarka, blew his conch shell, and all the citizens experienced Krishna's return as if their life had returned to their bodies. Because Krishna is the life of the soul. He is the soul of the soul. That is the meaning of the super soul. Without the soul within the body has no life. And without the super soul, the soul has no life. We now think that we're alive, but actually we are dead. We are just like Karputli, Putulnach, marionettes, just like a dancing puppet, a dancing doll. And the strings are being pulled by the modes of material nature. We see it in the children. They may want to stay, but one mode of material nature or one sense, boop, and they have to leave. But it's happening to all of us continuously, just being controlled by the modes and our senses. Putulnach, a dancing doll. So when the real life enters the soul and Krishna consciousness, when the soul is connected with the internal potency of the Lord, he awakens his real life. It is a new life, a fresh life, real life. We really see, we really touch, we really smell, we really taste, we really speak, we are alive. So, the residents of Dwarka were experiencing Krishna's absence as if the life had left their body. And Krishna entered the city and everyone came rushing out because they truly loved him. They rushed out and he reciprocated with their affection for him according to their position. So we've seen very intimate dealings of Krishna himself. We've heard that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna is Tu Bhagavan Swayam, the Adya Narayan. Even Bhishma Dev said this. And we've seen him deal with his devotees in wonderful ways, in affectionate ways, protecting them again and again, solving their difficulties again and again, accepting their prayers. And we won't actually have such a glimpse, an intimate glimpse of the Supreme Personality of Godhead until Canto 10. Sometimes if you're walking in the in a place, in a shopping center or something like that, or some stores, there'll be one person handing out a taste, you know, a small little piece of something to eat. They're selling it, and they have so much faith in their product that they're thinking that if we give you this little piece, you're simply going to want more and more and more. So similarly, we've gotten a taste in this first canto of Krishna's dealings with his devotees. We're going to get more in the first canto in a few more chapters when Arjuna remembers his dealings with Krishna. Very similar. Hearing how Krishna deals with his devotees. And then in the third canto, when Uddhava has just left Krishna after Krishna has left this planet, he speaks of Krishna's pastimes within Vrindavan and without of Vrindavan. But outside of that, those brief interludes, we won't actually see that Supreme Personality of Godhead, the all-attractive Lord. We won't see him again until we'll see his different avatars. We'll see Leela avatars, we'll see Guna avatars, we'll see Purusha avatars. We'll hear of Krishna's dealings with wonderful, wonderful dealings with so many devotees, but Krishna himself, the Supreme Lord, our longing to meet him and hear about him directly will be increasing, increasing, increasing until the 10th canto. So now, Krishna has entered Dwarka and he's greeted the ordinary citizens who are not really ordinary at all, because they're all most exalted personages, that they're so exalted that they can see the Supreme Lord face to face so often, regularly, daily. And now we're going to see three things. First, the ladies in text 24 or so, the ladies in Dwarka went up on the roofs to have a look at the Lord. You can get because they couldn't get close otherwise, but on the roofs they could see him more closely. And then a few verses describe the Lord's beauty, the incredible beauty of the Lord. Then Krishna enters the first place he enters into his parents' home. He sees his father and mothers and shows them respect. And then he enters his own palaces and He separates into 16,108 Krishnas so he can be with each of his 16,108 wives. This is called Bhaivav, the equal expansions of the Lord. And then there's a little bit of a discussion or a glimpse of the intimate dealings between Krishna, the conjugal dealings between Krishna and his queens. We have heard about this in the previous chapters, how glorious, how fortunate, how supremely fortunate the queens were because of the intimacy of their dealings with Krishna. And now we're going to actually see something of that. And then, ever so quickly, Suta Goswami explains the nature, the very nature of the relationship between Krishna and his queens. So we're not allowed to think that it is in any way mundane. Because superficially, because this is called Naralila, or the activities of the Lord that mimic, they are like those of human activities, of everyone's human activities. They are very much like that. But they are not the activities that human beings perform. They are completely under the control of the internal energy. They're executed by Krishna's free will, far different from the activities that we perform in the material world. So Suta Goswami will describe very, very sweetly, give a purport to these dealings between Krishna and the queens. So here, in text 24, the queens, or the ladies from the respectable families of Dwarka, went onto the roofs. In 25, which we read yesterday and read the purport, we heard about the inhabitants of Dwarka who were regularly accustomed to look upon the reservoir of all beauty. The reservoir of all beauty. What a wonderful concept. A reservoir is where water is stored, and it is distributed from that point. So similarly, beauty is stored in the person of Krishna. He is all beautiful. So they were so fortunate because they were always able to look at Krishna, but yet they were never satiated. That means that they never had enough. When we deal with mundane things, we can look at something mundanely attractive and beautiful, etc., or tasty, but we become satiated after a while and want to change to something else. But the nature of Krishna's beauty is that someone who actually gets a glimpse of it, he is never satiated. Rather, he wants more and more and more and more. So much so that Rupa Goswami says that when chanting Krishna's names, we can just get a glimpse of what sweet potency is in Krishna's name. Abhinatam namaname namanamano. That is no different from Krishna. It's so sweet that Rupa Goswami is wishing that he had 1,000 tongues to be able to chant Krishna's names. And 1,000 ears to be able to hear, because one tongue and one ear isn't sufficient. Because the more that one properly hears and properly chants Krishna's name, one wants more and more and more and more. So, in a few verses, there is a description of Krishna's beauty. The Lord's chest, as seen by the ladies, respectable ladies on the roof, the roofs. The Lord's chest is the abode of the goddess of fortune. His moon-like face is the drinking vessel for eyes which hanker after all that is beautiful. His arms are the resting place for the administrative demigods, because the administrative demigods are so powerful. So Krishna's arms are so powerful as his moon-like face is so beautiful. And his lotus feet are the refuge of pure devotees who never talk or sing of any subject except his lordship. It is not that the pure devotees are thinking, I am not allowed to sing of anything but Krishna, and therefore I have to control myself. No, their attraction to Krishna is so powerful that they naturally sing and speak only about Krishna. Prabhupada's purport describes the Lord is called the essence of everything is the Supreme Lord. There's a wonderful prayer by Rupa Goswami in this. Listen carefully. The essence of everything is the Supreme Lord. He is called Saram. And those who sing and talk about him are called Sarangas, or the pure devotees. The pure devotees are always hankering after the lotus feet of the Lord. The lotus has a kind of honey which is transcendentally relished by the devotees. They are like the bees who are always after the honey. Srila Rupa Goswami, the great devotee Acharya in the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, has sung a song about this lotus honey, comparing himself to a bee. O my Lord Krishna, I beg to offer my prayers unto you. My mind is like the bee, and it is after some honey. Kindly, therefore, give my bee mind a place at your lotus feet, which are the resources for all transcendental honey. I know that even big demigods like Brahma do not see the rays of the nails of your lotus feet, even though they are engaged in deep meditation for years together. Still, O infallible one, my ambition is such, for you are very merciful to your surrendered devotees. O Madhava, I know also that I have no genuine devotion for the service of your lotus feet. But because your lordship is inconceivably powerful, you can do what is impossible to be done. Your lotus feet can deride even the nectar of the heavenly kingdom. And therefore I am very much attracted by them. O Supreme Eternal, please be able to relish the taste. Please, therefore, let my mind be fixed at your lotus feet, so that eternally I may be able to relish the taste of your transcendental service. The devotees are satisfied with being placed at the lotus feet of the Lord and have no ambition to see his all-beautiful face or aspire for the protection of the strong arms of the Lord. They are humble by nature, and the Lord is always leaning towards such humble devotees. That was from text 26. So that was all in the description of how the lotus feet of the Lord are the refuge of the pure devotees. Further description of his beauty. As the Lord passed along the public road of Dwarka, his head was protected from the sunshine by a white umbrella. White feathered fans moved in semicircles. Chamaras. And a shower of flowers fell upon the road. His yellow garments and garlands of flowers made it appear as if a dark cloud was surrounded simultaneously by sun, moon, lightning, and rainbows. So what a wonderful picture to think about, how Krishna enters Dwarka looking so beautiful, being surrounded by these beautiful items, flower petals, a chamara, a white umbrella, which are compared to natural phenomena, which are existing all at the same time, while in nature they don't exist simultaneously. The sun, the moon, lightning, like this, they don't all aren't there at the same time. So how beautiful this is, and rainbows. So then Krishna, after being accompanied by this festive group of devotees all looking at him and him glancing very sweetly and affectionately towards them, he enters the house of his father. And there, Krishna is embraced by his mothers who were present, and the Lord offered his obeisances unto them by placing his head at their feet. The mothers were headed by Devaki, who was his actual real mother. The mothers, after embracing their son, sat him on their laps. Due to pure affection, milk sprang from their breasts. They were overwhelmed with delight, and the tears from their eyes wetted the Lord. They were so affectionate. This is the nature of a mother. They always see their child, even if the child is 50 or 60 years old, they'll see him as a little boy. So as soon as Krishna came, they took him on their laps, and tears, they bathed him with their tears, milk came to their breasts. And Krishna was already, this was after the battle of Kurukshetra, so he was quite elderly at this time. Sometimes I've heard Prabhupada say, oh, Krishna was in this world for 125 years, so he was over 50, 60, 70. Over 100, but looking still like 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, like that. But still, this is the nature of a mother. She just sees her child, no matter the age, as a little boy. Thereafter, after exchanging affection with his mothers, the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. His wives lived in them, and they numbered over 16,000. The queens of Lord Krishna rejoiced within their minds to see their husbands home after a long period of abroad. So everyone ran out to see Krishna, but not the queens. This was not culturally proper. Not according to etiquette that the queens would run out to see the Lord and be seen in public like in this way. They were too shy also. And the dealing was too intimate. So they were so happy to see their husband home after a long period abroad. Because he had been away Krishna was sorting out, as will be described later, he was actually fulfilling his mission of removing the burden of the earth. He had assembled everyone together, all the extra military forces, unnecessary military forces, he had assembled everyone together on the field of Kurukshetra. And then he had them fight each other. And in this way, the burden of the earth was removed. So for a long time, Krishna was away. So the queens, they got up at once from their seats after Krishna entered the palace. They got up at once from their seats and their meditations. And what were they meditating upon? Certainly not the impersonal Brahman. They were meditating only upon Krishna. When will he come? When will he come? They loved him so much. As was socially customary, they covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly. Very shyly they looked around. So Krishna, at this point, divided himself into 16,108 Krishnas, and each palace Krishna entered. Because just imagine if he had so many wives, and what would have happened if he either, there's two ways he could have done it, there's three ways he could have done it, and he chose this one for obvious reasons. If he would have entered one palace after another, what would have happened? It would have taken a very long time. Even if he stayed 1 minute in each palace, that would have been 16,000 minutes, which is a lot of hours. And then he would have to go around and circle again. So that wouldn't have been satisfying for anyone. Or if he brought all the queens together and saw them all at the same time and said, I am back. There would have been no intimacy in that. So that wouldn't have satisfied anyone. So Krishna, to satisfy his beloved queens who had so much affection from him, he divided himself into 16,108 Krishnas and simultaneously entered each palace. This is wonderful. And in each palace, he did different things, acted differently according to the needs of the time. This is called Vaibhav. So someone can think, well, that's pretty extraordinary that Krishna divided himself into 16,108 Krishnas and entered each palace. And the answer to that is yes, it is certainly extraordinary. Because without being the most extraordinary, what is the meaning for Krishna to be God? This is the meaning, as Prabhupada explains in his purport, that God is great. Everyone knows that God is great. So when he does something so great, this is wonderful. And everyone should just appreciate the greatness of God. And this is actually not even difficult for him to do, to expand into 16,108 Krishnas and enter each palace. This is what God is, not that cheap imitation gods from the factory of mystic yoga or some meditation that after meditating one becomes God. No. Absurd. So the queens were very shy when they saw Krishna. The insuperable ecstasy, the incomparable ecstasy was so strong, irrepressible. They could not control their ecstasy on seeing the Lord, although they were very shy. Their ecstasy was so strong that the queens, who were shy, first embraced the Lord in the innermost recesses of their hearts. This is how it expressed itself, their ecstasy. Then they embraced him visually. With their eyes they embraced him. And then they sent their sons to embrace him, which is equal to personal embracing. But, O chief amongst the Bhrigus, though they tried to restrain their feelings, they inadvertently shed tears. So we can just imagine the wonder of Krishna's beauty and attractiveness. His power, his knowledge, his strength, his fame. If we know someone who is very famous or rich, we are very happy that we know that person. We drop their name. We say, yes, I know this one. And that gives us some pleasure to be somehow connected with that person. Even if our relationship is not so intimate. So how the queens must have felt through the intimacy of their relationship with this supreme person. Although Lord Sri Krishna was constantly by their sides, as well as exclusively alone, his feet appeared to them to be newer and newer. That means their relationship with him was ever fresh. There's that saying, familiarity breeds contempt. But Krishna was always with them and always aloof too, simultaneously. And he was all attractive and he's nava yovanam, ever freshly, his qualities are ever freshly and ever newly expanding unlimitedly. So there was no contempt due to familiarity. So his feet, his service, appeared to them to be newer and newer. The goddess of fortune, although by nature always restless and moving, could not quit the Lord's feet. So what woman can be detached from those feet having taken shelter of them once. Prabhupada's purport. Conditioned living beings are always after the favor of the goddess of fortune, although by nature she is moving from one place to another. In the material world, no one is permanently fortunate. What is that word that is used to describe Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune? Chancha. Which means that is, she's not steady, unsteady. Chanchal, or Krishna uses that word to describe the mind in the Bhagavad Gita, the same word, chanchalam hi, mana Krishna. Is there an eva in that too? I think so. It's just chanchalam hi, mana Krishna, that the mind is always flickering, unsteady, fickle. The mind is so fickle. First it loves something, it's so attracted to, then 1 second later, it could be averse to that very same thing that it was so attracted to. This is the nature of the fickle mind. And similarly, fortune is like that. Someone, their fortune builds and builds and builds, and they're so powerful. And then suddenly, boom, they're in jail and penniless. So there have been so many big empires in different parts of the world. There have been so many powerful kings all over the world. And there have been so many fortunate men. But all of them have been liquidated gradually. This is the law of material nature. But spiritually it is different. According to the Brahma Samhita, the Lord is served very respectfully by hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune. That means his qualities are such that the goddess of fortune remains steady when serving him. She loses her chanchala nature. They are always in a lonely place also with the Lord, but still the association of the Lord is so inspiringly newer and newer that they cannot quit the Lord for a moment, even though they are by nature very restless and are moving about. The spiritual relation with the Lord is so enlivening and resourceful that no one can leave the company of the Lord once having taken shelter of him. So now Krishna has entered the palace. Then there is a few verses that describe what had occurred while Krishna was away. He had accomplished his mission, and because this Lord, the Supreme Lord, was on the planet, what did he do? What were the activities? So it describes, the Lord was pacified because he's home now. After killing those kings who were burdensome to the earth, they were puffed up with their military strength, their horses, elephants, chariots, infantry, etc. He himself was not a party in the fight. Which fight is this? Kurukshetra. He simply created hostility between the powerful administrators, and they fought amongst themselves. He was like the wind, which causes friction between bamboos, and so sparks of fire. I'm going to read some of Prabhupada's purport here, which is somewhat a prediction. Puffed up by such a false sense of becoming God, the deluded living being increases his material strength by so many activities and thus becomes the burden of the earth. So much so that the earth becomes completely uninhabitable by the sane. This state of human affairs is called damasya glaniya, or misuse of the energy of the human being. When such misuse of human energy is prominent, the saner living beings become perturbed by the awkward situation created by the vicious administrators who are simply burdens of the earth, and the Lord appears by his internal potency just to save the saner section of humanity and to alleviate the burden due to the earthly administrators in different parts of the world. He does not favor either of the unwanted administrators, but by his potential power, he creates hostility between such unwanted administrators as the air creates fire in the forest by the friction of the bamboos. The fire in the forest takes place automatically by the force of the air, and similarly, the hostility between different groups of politicians takes place by the unseen design of the Lord. The unwanted administrators, puffed up by false power and military strength, thus become engaged in fighting amongst themselves over ideological conflicts and so exhaust themselves of all powers. The history of the world reflects this factual will of the Lord, and it will continue to be enacted until the living beings are attached to the service of the Lord. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, appeared on this planet by his internal potency and enjoyed himself amongst competent women as if he were engaged in mundane affairs. So, these women, or anyone that Krishna was actually enjoying with, carrying on his pastimes with while he appeared on earth, and we've just heard chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, and here in chapter 11, it's at the sum total of the introductory pastimes of Krishna, hearing just a glimpsing the dealings between Krishna and his queens at Dwarka. All these dealings, they have nothing to do with the material energy at all. We may have similar dealings, but our dealings are simply perverted reflections of Krishna's dealings. At this point, all we can do is intellectually understand this. Or maybe glimpse at it. Or understand that if there is some attraction or some pleasure in the dealings between man and woman, or friend and friend, or parent and children and parent, and servant and master in this world, or if there is some rasa, there is some taste of sweetness in that, then we can imagine, we can just imagine how many billion times, if we took whatever sweetness is there and multiply it by a billion, billion, billion times, then we could get a glimpse of what relating with Krishna in one of the rasas is like. So these, the dealings between Krishna and his devotees, these intimate dealings have nothing to do with the material energy whatsoever. They all take place by this internal energy, the antaranga shakti, or the chit shakti, the lila shakti of Krishna. And these dealings are so wonderful that Krishna himself becomes surprised at what happens. Because just imagine, if we think about it, that if Krishna, he's Sarvajna, he knows past, present, and future, he knows everything. So nothing can be a surprise for him. So that would, if nothing can be a surprise in the dealings, if he knows what's going to happen always, that would make life very boring for him, eternal life very boring for him. But Krishna places, although he is all-knowing, he places the dealings between his devotees, the leelas, under his internal energy. And he doesn't think about them, and then they occur. And he becomes surprised. We read about this when Krishna was playing with his cowherd boyfriends, and the cowherd boys entered into the mouth of the Aghasura, that sinful demon. Krishna himself was surprised. How amazingly the His leelas are going on. He doesn't know what's going to happen next leela, because the very nature of Krishna is that he's savagya, knows everything, but when it comes to his leelas, he is also mudgata. His consciousness becomes compressed within the leela, so he acts just like an ordinary person. But yet he knows everything. But yet he is living within that leela and is actually surprised. So this is inconceivable. Yes, it's inconceivable. So all these dealings with Krishna and his devotees, the queens and everyone, they're all going on by Krishna's internal energy. Completely different than material dealings. Now, in 36, 37, 38, and 39, Shrisuta is going to explain the nature of these dealings between Krishna and his queens. And this is very, very important. Now, we're not going to read all of Srila Prabhupada's purports. We'll read all the verses, but we won't read all the purports. But I highly recommend that everyone read these, because they are pointed and important. We'll try to capture a glimpse of their sweetness. Although the queen's beautiful smiles and furtive glances, furtive means secret, because they were glancing at him from the corner of their eye and capturing his attention and his mind in that way. Although the queen's beautiful smiles and furtive glances were all spotless and exciting, and although they could conquer Cupid himself by making him give up his bow in frustration, and although even the tolerant Shiva could fall victim to them, still, despite all their magical feats and attractions, they could not agitate the senses of the Lord. Because in this world, the attraction between male and female is supreme. This is the supreme force in this world. But Krishna was not at all attracted or moved by their glances. But yet, he was moved. Now what impelled him? It wasn't Cupid or calm or lust or the desire to enjoy. What impels Krishna to engage in these dealings with the queens, or for that matter, any of his devotees? So Prabhupada explains in the purport. Oh, actually, I'm going to read the verses first, and then we'll read the elements of the purport. The common materialistic conditioned souls speculate that the Lord is one of them, thinking naturally Krishna is going to go to the queens. He quickly touches his mother's feet, and then he goes to his queen's palace to enjoy with them. Yeah, I can understand that. But this is the way a conditioned soul thinks, thinking that the Lord is one just like them. Out of their ignorance, they think that the Lord is affected by matter, although he is unattached, just like the sun, when it can go over a filthy place and remain fully pure. So Krishna is so powerful, there is no tinge of impurity in him. This is the divine quality, the divinity of the personality of Godhead. He is not affected by the qualities of material nature, even though he is in contact with them. Similarly, the devotees who have taken shelter of the Lord do not become influenced by material qualities. The simple and delicate women truly thought that the Supreme Lord Krishna, Lord Sri Krishna, their beloved husband, followed them and was dominated by them. They were unaware of the extent of the glories of their husband, as the atheists are unaware of him as the Supreme Controller. So they thought that Krishna was being controlled by them, by their clever, and they were shooting glances like arrows out of the side of their eyes and capturing Krishna's mind like that. And they thought that Krishna was more or less henpecked, that he was under their control. And indeed, when Satyabhauma wanted a Parijata flower, Krishna went up to Indralok and brought down a plant just to satisfy his beloved wife. So it appeared that Krishna was henpecked under their control. They thought like that, and materialists can understand like that, but actually it has nothing to do with that at all. It has nothing to do with anything material. Even the slightest tinge of matter is absent. So we'll read some of Prabhupada's purports. The Lord could not, his senses were never agitated. Therefore, the queens could not satisfy the Lord by their feminine attractiveness, but they satisfied him by their sincere affection and service. Only by unalloyed transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord, and the Lord was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. So Krishna was simply reciprocating with their specific personal desire to love him in a specific mood and relationship, because there's a limit to how much one's love can grow if one has general love. One has to love in a specific relationship. Either servitorship, dasya, sukha, friendship, or vatsal, paternal, maternal, or madhurja, shungara rasa, conjugal rasa. If one wants to love Krishna, for it to be, to develop, it has to be in a specific way. And Krishna, when one actually is qualified to love Krishna in a specific way, he reciprocates with that devotee according to the pure love that that devotee wants to offer Krishna. So Krishna, due to their sincere affection and service, was pleased to treat the wives in that way in reciprocation. Thus, being satisfied by their unalloyed service only, the Lord reciprocated the service just like a devout husband. They wanted to him to act as a devout husband. They loved him in that way, purely, in a pure spiritual way. Loved him in service, nothing selfish. And Krishna was pleased to act as their devout husband. Otherwise, he had no business becoming the husband of so many wives. He's the husband of everyone, but to one who accepts him as such, he reciprocates. The unalloyed affection for the Lord is never to be compared to mundane lust. It is purely transcendental, and the grave dealings which the queens displayed in natural feminine waves were also transcendental, because the feelings were expressed out of transcendental ecstasy. Grave meaning very deep, their deep feelings. Not at all mundane, just on the transcendental loving level. It is already explained in the previous verse that the Lord appeared like a mundane husband, but factually his relation with his wives was transcendental, pure, and unconditioned by the modes of material nature. So there was no ignorance in the Lord's actions at all, no tinge of material dealings. And then in the next verse, in text 38 rather, we'll read that purport, half that purport, and then the last purport, and then we'll end. Actually, because in this verse, in text 38, it describes how Krishna was unaffected by material qualities, just like the devotees are unaffected. So if the devotees are unaffected, how could their master be affected? Actually, he is in contact with such qualities because he is the ultimate source of everything, meaning mundane qualities. Because he is the source, nothing is separate from him. Yet he is above the action of such qualities. He is known, therefore, as Yogeshwar, or the master of mystic power, or in other words, the all-powerful. Even his learned devotees are not affected by the influence of the material modes. The great six Goswamis of Vrindavan all came from greatly rich and aristocratic families. But when they adopted the life of mendicants at Vrindavan, superficially they appeared to be in a wretched condition of life. But factually they were the richest of all in spiritual values. Such Mahabhagavatas, or first great devotees, although moving amongst men, are not contaminated by honor or insult, hunger or satisfaction, sleep or wakefulness, which are all resultant actions of the three modes of material nature. Similarly, some of them are engaged in worldly dealings, yet are unaffected. Unless these neutralities of life are there, one cannot be considered situated in transcendence. The divinity and his associates are on the same transcendental plane, and their glories are always sanctified by the actions of Yogamaya, or the internal potency of the Lord. The devotees of the Lord are always transcendental, even if they are sometimes found to have fallen in their behavior. The Lord emphatically declares in the Bhagavad Gita 9:30 that even if an unalloyed devotee is found to be fallen due to a previous material contamination, he is nevertheless to be accepted as fully transcendental because of his being engaged 100% in the devotional service of the Lord. The Lord protects him always because of his rendering service unto him, and the fallen conditions are to be considered accidental and temporary. They will vanish in no time. And then finally, the last purport. Even the transcendental wives of Lord Sri Krishna did not know completely the unfathomable glories of the Lord. This ignorance is not mundane, because there is some action of the internal potency of the Lord in the exchange of feelings between him and his eternal associates. Actually, everything that was going on is simply the dealings of the internal energy of Krishna. Just like everything in this world is the dealing of Maya. The Lord exchanges transcendental relations in five ways, as proprietor, master, friend, son, and lover. And each of these pastimes he plays fully by the potency of Yogamaya, the internal potency. He plays exactly like an equal friend with the cowherd boys, or even with friends like Arjuna. He plays like a son in the presence of Yasoda Mata. He plays exactly like a lover in the presence of the cowherd damsels. And he plays exactly like a husband in the presence of the queens of Dwarka. Such devotees never think of the Lord as supreme, but they think of him exactly as a common friend, a pet son, or a lover, a husband, very much dear to the heart and soul. That is the relation between the Lord and his transcendental devotees, who act as his associates in the spiritual sky, where there are innumerable Vaikuntha planets. When the Lord descends, he does so along with his entourage, to display a complete picture of the transcendental world, where pure love and devotion for the Lord prevail without any mundane tinge of lording it over the creation of the Lord. Such devotees of the Lord are all liberated souls, perfect representatives of the marginal or the internal potency in complete negation of the influence of the external potency. The wives of Lord Krishna were made to forget the immeasurable glories of the Lord by the internal potency, so that there might not be any flaw of exchange. And they took it for granted that the Lord was a henpecked husband, always following them in lonely places. In other words, even the personal associates of the Lord do not know him perfectly well. So what do the thesis writers or mental speculators know about the transcendental glories of the Lord? The mental speculators present different theses as to his becoming the cause of the creation, the ingredients of the creation, or the material and efficient cause of the creation, etc. But all this is but partial knowledge about the Lord. Because Krishna doesn't do those things himself. He doesn't deal with the material world. He doesn't become anything in the material world. He does this all through his energies. So this is speculation. It is not accurate. It is a partial knowledge of the Lord. Factually, through speculation, they are as ignorant as the common man. The Lord can be known by the mercy of the Lord only, and by no other means. But since the dealings of the Lord with his wives are based on pure transcendental love and devotion, the wives are all on the transcendental plane without material contamination. So that ends the 11th chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. When we begin next week, we're going to skip chapter 12 and go on to chapter 13. And we'll catch up with chapter 12 later when we talk about Maharaj Prakriti. So this is very wonderful. Krishna comes with his entourage to it, and he displays his different leelas, pastimes with these exalted personalities, all going on by the internal energy to attract us to that place. Because our relationships here are simply a perverted reflection of the reality of the Lord's, of the dealings with the Lord, where he is the Vishaya, he is the object of all relationships. So we should become attracted. If we don't become attracted to go and awaken our spiritual relationship with Krishna, we'll become attracted to the material world and become entangled. So even if our level of advancement is that we have some attractions to matter, naturally, we should still hear about Krishna and thereby awaken more and more our loving relationship with him. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments?
In that last bit, what you just read, mentioned the devotees become perfect representations of the marginal or internal potency.
Yeah.
Could you just say something about some of
the potencies? Yes, yeah, there are different devotees who are the different members of Krishna's Leela. They're in two categories. They're either Krishna's Shakti, the Shakti Tattva, Krishna's internal energy, or they're jivas, who have either become perfect or were forever perfect. So that's the meaning of that. So the perfect representatives of that, as opposed to, of course, the internal, the Shakti Tattva can't be ever become imperfect, but the jivas can become fallible. Dvayema purusha loke chara akshara eva cha chara savabhutani kutosto akshara uchate. But there are two kinds of living entities, the fallible and the infallible. And the infallible, the perfect, are perfect because kutosto, they are one with Krishna in desire. So when we become one with Krishna in desire, we become perfect also. And then we are placed under the control of the internal energy, although we are still individuals, and then we happily serve Krishna.